Welcome to the In Focus podcast. I am G. Anantakrishnan, Senior Associate Editor of The Hindu, and your host for today. I will be speaking with wildlife biologist K. Ulas Karanth, who is the Director of the Center for Wildlife Studies, Bengaluru. Dr. Karanth trained as an engineer, but he was so fascinated by wildlife that he decided to become a wildlife biologist, and after taking a PhD, dedicated his career to studying wild tigers and their conservation using science. Dr. Karanth's work has focused on the ecology of tigers and how to count them scientifically. He has published more than 75 peer-reviewed papers in prestigious journals and written many books, one of them entitled The Science of Saving Tigers. Today, I will be asking Dr. Ulas Karanth about the report on the status of tigers released recently by the Government of India, by which estimate India has 2,967 tigers, and how the world can ensure a future for tigers and for other species.
So this latest status of tigers, co-predators and prey has come out. And they have a number there, of course, an estimate of, some confidence interval estimate of maybe 2,967 tigers. So I wanted to ask you straight off, I don't know whether you had the opportunity to really spend time with the report. It seems to be quite large. So what do you think of the number itself, as a count?
No, I see this is not a new report. About a little over a year ago, a summary of this was released, and now they have just printed it on glossy paper and added a lot of photos of tigers. So the content is the same, and this is an approach that we have criticized by and other statisticians and many others have criticized from 2006 when they introduced this approach of estimating tiger numbers over large areas using what a method called index calibration using different approaches. So this method is completely invalid. So I don't think the results are accurate this time, or were they accurate the previous time or before that. So I don't worry too much about these numbers.
So what would be, sort of useful method to assess the health of, tigers in, the subcontinent, particularly in India?
Yeah, see, there are two, all this has been actually repeatedly critiqued, alternative offered in peer-reviewed publications, but they go on sticking on to this methodology, which has never received proper peer review, and the data are completely hidden. They are not shared with any scientist all the way from the 2006 survey when they introduced this methodology. The raw data are completely hidden from any scientific scrutiny. So there are very many better ways of approaching the problem. The way they do it, the first problem is that they try to go for these all India regional large landscape numbers. The way they try to connect the camera trap surveys in smaller areas to track surveys across larger landscape is fundamentally statistically flawed. It's a futile exercise. But my main point is there's no point in going for these very large scale numbers, which have such variances and such weak links, because the information provided by tracks is very, very poor. So I think we should not worry too much about them. But if they want to do it, there are better methods than what they're using. But to me, the key issue is 75 to 80% of the tigers, perhaps even more, are concentrated in a very small fraction of the area. We have 3 lakh square kilometers of tiger habitat that is roughly surveyed, of which only 30 or 40,000 square kilometers is where the somewhat viable breeding populations are there. So that is where 70 to 80% perhaps, or even higher proportion of tigers are there. Those need to be monitored rigorously. The problem is they are neither doing that well, nor this large-scale extrapolation well. There are fundamental flaws in the way they are estimating these numbers, because these camera trap surveys have to be done under a rigorous protocol called capture-recapture, which means you take repeated snapshots of the population, samples from the population, So they are violating a huge number of assumptions involved in there. So the net result is they are getting more and more tigers, but the tigers that are going are not deducted. So you get these ever increasing numbers. Longer you keep the cameras, more tigers you will get. So this is one of the many flaws. So I think what is required is a complete revamp, not trying to twiddle with the system that they have introduced, and they are persisting in spite of all scientific criticism.
Yeah, actually, I saw that after the 2010 data came out, you had said that 70% of the tigers are found in 42 source populations. And this has been the case despite a range contraction of 22%. That's what you had said at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. At one of the surveys, I think it was 2010, they said the habitat has shrunk and the densities have gone up by 45%. Which is ridiculous. And some of the, so what I am saying is this whole business of turning it into a massive bureaucratic monopoly where there is a series of conflict of interest, the NPCA, the government officials in charge of parks, and WII all have a vested interest in portraying everything is fine. So this leads to not an independent audit like the CAG does or any auditing mechanism does. It leads to a mutually reinforcing system of claims backed by very little else. And the sad thing is, with all this, what is there to pat yourself on the back about? There were about 2,000 tigers roughly in 1970. Now, in 50 years later, there are about 3,000 tigers. So what's the big deal? Still 70% of the tiger habitat or more where we can have tigers is virtually unoccupied. So I see no need to celebrate, kind of hoodwink the public with all these glossy magazines. The problem is nobody goes deep into the core of the report. There are no details of anything, any use, which can allow a scientific examination of the report. There are just these numbers. There are some photos of tigers and lots of nice scenery and wildlife pictures. This is not science.
Yeah, in fact, I'd like to go back to that issue of science, because I remember that you had written in 2004, I think, there was a paper in which you had said that you had studied Panna and said that if you can manage that Central Indian dry forest habitat carefully, then you can support 9,000 wild tigers. So
I think that was I think Raghu's estimate of some kind, but I have my estimate is there is about 3 lakh square kilometers of habitat, potential tiger habitat. Even if you maintain an average density of 5 tigers per 100 square kilometers, whereas some of these areas can have 15, which is very high, but even if you have 5, you are talking about 15,000 tigers. Even if you are talking about 3 or 4 tigers per 100 square kilometers, you are talking about 10,000 tigers in India. Yes, we are, after 50 years, we have kind of added 1,000 tigers to the whole population, and we are going around celebrating like there is no tomorrow. This is the problem.
So this issue of source populations, you know, for the average person to try and understand that, would you explain the significance of source populations and where they are at in India today?
Yeah. See, basically, tigers have high reproductive rates and high mortality rates. So, if the reproduction is not kept up, they very quickly disappear because their mortality rates are high. They get killed by people, they have intraspecific aggression, they starve to death if there is no prey, they get killed in hunting accidents. So, mortality is high. So, the key is to keep the reproduction high. So, those populations are areas in which the reproduction is higher than mortality, so there is a slight surplus being produced. These are called source populations. And this was in an analysis we published in 2010, a global analysis, which showed that nearly 60-70% of the world's tigers are found only in 6-7% of the area of the habitat. So these are source populations, and protecting them is key. For example, Nagarhole or Bandipur or Kana, these are obviously source populations. But we have to have enough of them, and each one has to be large enough. So we have this surplus that has the potential to recolonize the other areas gradually. So the other areas outside the source are essentially sink, because that is where the reproduction is far lower than the losses. So unless there is inflow from these sources, these sinks are just absorbing tigers. That's why they are called sinks.
You had spent quality effort in Nagarhole, which I had the occasion to see.
Yes.
So could you talk about the success of Nagarhole, how that came about? And, I presume that the numbers are very healthy there, even now.
There were many sites. Nagarhole is one of them where I was lucky to, in fact, the Karnataka Western Ghats is where I have been able to put proper monitoring systems, and nearly 30 years we applied the best methods and we have the data. But this model of recovery in Nagarhole and other places has very simple elements. Number one is you need law enforcement, so people hunting the prey are forbidden. They are stopped. Because without a prey base, however beautiful the forest looks from the aerial maps or satellite images, tigers cannot make it there. This is the global problem for tigers, is we have enough forest but don't have prey. So that's the first step. So second step is, occasionally when there are concentrations of tigers, very determined poachers may try to come and kill them, like it happened in Panna and Sarista. So you need some enforcement, but the enforcement is same, whether it's prey or tigers, it's patrolling, two guards going around. There is no rocket science to it. That is essential. Second thing is, if there are livestock raising, agriculture and human activities inside, extraction of non-timber forest products, logging, this interspersion does not work with tigers, breeding tiger population. On the edges, you may be able to deal with the conflict. Inside, what happens is, when tigers kill people or livestock, they get poisoned. So this is a perennial conflict. And in name of legitimate activities, a lot of poachers can go and set snares and poison water holes and do what they want. So the key is actually not everywhere, but in these key source populations, we incentivize people to move out. This was difficult in earlier years because people didn't have opportunities outside. But it's actually become quite easy now because people themselves are quite willing to go in search of education, employment. A lot of them don't find it, particularly with increasing numbers and holdings getting smaller. People want to move out. So that is where the emphasis has to be. And these are few simple things that need to be done. Then you need to put a good audit mechanism, a monitoring system in place. You know whether things are working or not. So that's all that is involved in bringing back tigers.
So has it actually been replicated elsewhere, what you have done in Nagarhole?
No. If you are talking about the monitoring part, no. Because it took a lot of effort. We put a sort of serious science into it right from 1980s when we began estimating prey. For example, how many tigers can be there in an area? Straight away, a rule of the thumb calculation is 500 prey for one tiger. That gives you an estimate. So determining prey density using proper methodology is important, and we established the methodology, we developed the data. Not in a single part they are doing it right after all these years. It's nothing. It's a simple method called distance sampling or line transect sampling. So the second thing, if you get past that, if you have cameras, if you have other things, you can actually go beyond saying there can be 100 tigers in this place based on prey. You can go and actually see how many there are. And that is where rigorous camera trapping is important. And the key thing is, you got to do it every year, not once in 4 years, because tigers have mortality rates of 20% per year. In 4 years, all the original tigers are virtually gone. So there is no continuity in the data, no estimate of survival rate, no estimate of losses, gains. Nothing is possible the way they are doing these things, simply putting cameras and calling it the gold standard.
Yeah, so we essentially means that these various figures that have come out since 2006, they are, for one thing, they are not comparable, and they are not, wholly accurate.
Accurate. Yeah, and the key is, Anant, in 2017, we brought out a monograph. It took 2 years of effort. We brought everybody some of the best tiger biologists, the best biostatisticians to Bangalore, Indian Statistical Institute. We sat there, we discussed, it came up, and Mr. Jawdekar even sent a message of encouragement when we had that. In 2017, we published a monograph with 31 authors elaborating each one of these methods in great detail, and there is no interest in absorbing any of it. This is like we are in the era of cell phones. We are still using some old telephone wires and manual calls. There is no interest in using the best statistics, simply buying equipment everybody wants to buy. But how it is used is not regulated by any statistics or science.
So how do you think this should actually go in the future? I mean, if we assume that we want to have a robust estimate, we don't have a good baseline from what you have said so far. The baseline is faulty, but how do we sort of go forward at a national level to have...
I think there are two things. One is the question of monitoring. One is the question of overall tiger conservation. There are two different issues. So if you are talking about monitoring, it is very, very clear that the management and monitoring have to be independent of each other. The same bureaucracy managing the tiger and the same bureaucracy measuring the results simply doesn't work. So that complete independence has to be established by entrusting the monitoring to reputed scientific institutions. There are enough institutions and enough qualified people now, if they are all pooled together, can mount an independent monitoring of once a year monitoring system across India, at least at the source population level, perhaps even wider level. That is really the key. The present system of monitoring has to be first dismantled. If you look at tiger conservation as a whole, what I am seeing is a strange contradiction between the current government's policies in other arenas and in the conservation arena. In other arenas, they have tried to, I'm not saying they have succeeded, but at least they have tried to free up the economy from bureaucratic shackles. They have tried to free up even agricultural sector from some of these old top-down red tape-ridden systems. But when it comes to conservation, it's the reverse. We are having more and more bureaucracy, more and more government monopoly. Even sectors like tourism, in which the government has no expertise, is completely dominated by government. Research is dominated by government. Conservation education has to be dominated by government. There is no need for this. We need bureaucracy, certainly, for law enforcement, because a private sector cannot be the security agency for nature. That part has to be with the forest department or some other force to enforce the law. Beyond that, we should use the creative energy of India instead of building massive bureaucracies. You go to some of these states, the number of senior officers sitting there managing wildlife is mind-boggling. This is all not needed, and it will save a lot of money if they can just dismantle this bureaucracy.
So, actually, if you look at the kind of segmentation that they have given in the report in terms of the landscapes, you know, they have talked about the Shivalik, Gangetic, Central Indian, yeah. Western Ghats, and yeah. so on. So, yeah. Do you think this overall, that is a promising way forward in the sense that Central India can hold the maximum number of tigers followed by the Western Ghats? Is there any kind of conservation insight on that? What would you say?
No, see, the five big pieces they identify, which are disjunct in the sense there is not much movement between them, that's okay. But what would be very clear when you look at it, you can have maximum number of tigers. It's simply a function of the type of forest and the area of forest. So from that perspective, it is true that Central India has the largest blocks of forest, and their Central India is strange in the sense it includes Telangana, it includes Chhattisgarh, etc. The point is, if you look at India as a whole, there is a strange mismatch between where the tigers are and where the forests are. It is true some parts of Central India, Maharashtra, MP, there are large blocks of forest and there are substantial tigers. But if you look at all the other areas, like in the Western Ghats, in the Terai and in Assam, the tigers are in some of the most densely populated areas with the most fragmented forests. The most extensive forests in India are in Orissa, Jharkhand, Chhattisgarh, then again in the northeastern hill states. These are practically devoid of tigers, in relatively. So few tigers. So this is a striking thing, and the scope for bringing back tigers is actually where there is still suitable habitat, but tiger numbers are not there. But all our massive investments of this entire bureaucracy that I talked about, the huge budgets, budgets have inflated by 30 times in some of these reserves. They're all going into the areas where there are already tigers at reasonable density. The investments are not being directed, right? Basically, they're not being directed at the right things to do. They're being not spent on the right things like voluntary relocation, incentive-driven relocation, which will bring quick dividend.
How serious is fragmentation as a challenge to tiger conservation?
Fragmentation is a challenge not just for tigers, for any wide-ranging moving species. The more the habitat gets, fragmentation can happen in two things. One are linear intrusions that cut across. One is what is called honeycombing, little pieces of cancer that spread around. So both are fragmentation. But fragmentation is happening on multiple fronts. Often people think it's only the industry, highways, big projects that are causing problems, mines. Definitely they are causing problems. But equally, or if not more, fragmentation is being caused by rural roads, which is the biggest investment going into rural development. Every area they are putting metal rural roads. Biggest pressure is coming from electrification. Biggest pressure is coming from the improper implementation of the FRA, which is leading to patches of forest being colonized afresh after decades. So fragmentation is a threat on multiple fronts, one of which is big infrastructure.
So broadly, just to conclude, broadly, what would you say should be the priorities of environmental policy with conservation? Do we take the tiger as the apex animal in this case, which will, lead to further, downstream benefits? So what would you say should be our environmental approach? Now we have this whole idea of this EIA, which, many see as weakening the, framework. So what are your thoughts on conservation from a policy perspective?
My perspective is this was an approach advocated by Dr. John Robinson in the 1990s. It was a very thoughtful approach to conservation, which is to recognize certain species and certain areas, a proportion of the land has to be kept aside for wildlife. Now, these are strict protected areas, whatever you call them. I'm not saying tigers per se. For some species which are incompatible human users, can eliminate them, you need to have strict protected areas. Now, that proportion can't be very high in India because we have had a history of human occupation from 60,000 years. We have lost most of our areas. Perhaps we may be able to hit a figure of 10% for that, not more than that. Right now, our protected areas are less than 5%. So we should aim for 10% under strict protection for nature conservation. The other 90% we have to manage for humans, in which perhaps another 20 or 30% can be in multiple use landscape where some biodiversity, some form of wildlife that can coexist with people, a lot of birds can, a lot of other things can be managed for agriculture, wildlife, multiple use. Then another 10 or 15% we definitely need for intensive industry, urbanization, energy development and things like that, without which we cannot have the economic growth. And economic growth is fundamentally what people have demanded in successive elections. By ignoring that and saying, let's wind the clock back and we have conservation solutions in the 14th century, I do not agree. But I think it's this approach called sustainable landscapes, which is basically managing the land separately for conservation, for multiple use, and for intensive development. I think that's the way to go. And if we go that way, there is still room for 10,000 tigers. I would still argue that.
What about private tiger, private, reserves, in the sense that you buy land and then you rewild it and, make it available to nature? Does that appeal as a concept?
That is certainly one approach, and it has worked in other places, but the problems in India are slightly different, because unlike in the situation where it has worked best is in some of the Latin American areas, some of the African countries, land is very cheap, and that land is not very useful for many things other than very poor quality raising beef cattle. So there the switch is easier, to switch it to wildlife and earn more money from tourism. In India it becomes a little more tricky, because here the land is more productive and per acre far more expensive than in most places in the world. So our approach should be, at least where there is possibility of developing, say places like Nagarhole or Ranthambore, which are being crushed by tourism, outside those, if you can incentivize collectives of farmers or corporates in partnership with farmers to manage large areas for purely for wildlife instead of agriculture, which is suffering all these depredations, and as a result, the farmer makes more money, that will lead to an automatic expansion of our wildlife areas, providing them a buffer, rewilding, whatever you call. It's possible, but it's a little more tricky in terms of the economics. But I see no reason why it can't be done, given that we have a 300 million strong middle class, which is willing to spend. And right now, all that money and all that incentive is going to just trashing the existing 4% area under protected area, of which probably only 1% is under pressure. So we need to expand outwards from these areas where there is a possibility.
Thank you so much, Ulas, for sparing the time, giving us some insight.
Thank you, Anant. Always good talking to you, Anant.